Here's what the Apostle Paul has for us in Ephesians 5. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children and live in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. We'll skip to verse 8. For once, you were darkness, but now in the Lord, you are light. Live as children of light. For the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. Try to find out what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to mention what such people do secretly. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible. For everything that becomes visible is light. Therefore, it says, sleeper, awake, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. This is the word of the Lord. Yeah. Have I told you about the scary boy yet? Yeah. How many people have heard the story of the scary boy? Okay, I've told two people here in the room, it appears. That delights me because it was in my notes to tell you about the scary boy. I would have been severely disappointed if everyone had already heard the story. Hadley goes to sleep at night in her crib, and I go to tuck her in. And the next morning I come and I wake her up and she wipes the sleep from her eyes. Sleeper, awake, and she is awake. She looks at me and she says what she proclaims every morning, Daddy, I'm awake. Yes, we've heard you for the last 30 minutes kicking your crib. We know you are awake. And then she looks at me and she looks at a space in the room, in the ceiling. She looks back at me, and then she looks at the space, and then she holds her finger up, and she points at the space and says, scary boy. and I said, what? She goes, scary boy's right there. this goes on, Rex, for a little while. I mean, over days, scary boy makes an appearance in the room. If anyone wants to come and pray for we need an exorcist, is that right? Someone to exorcise the scary boy from my daughter's room. What lurks around at night in the darkness? The scary boy. Is that not the kind of the most freakiest, unsettling story you've ever heard? There's no good solution to this story at all. She just sees a scary boy and really freaks us out. We don't know what to do with it. Pray for us, would you? We think it's her imagination. We hope it's her imagination and that there's not some literal... I hope not. Sometimes I think, what would I do if I came in and there's someone there? I don't know who would be more scared, me or my daughter. Get back on track. Okay. Thank you. The darkness, there's something about the darkness that is unsettling when the lights go out, especially when you start to see things when the lights go out. There's something unnerving about it. Is anyone here scared of the darkness? Yeah, okay, Henry. Henry's not afraid to admit it. I'm not afraid to admit it. I hate the darkness. I hate the dark, scared of it. But maybe it's because I have the same imagination that my daughter has. And so when the lights go out, I can't stop myself from seeing things that are there or may not be there or that I'm afraid could be there. So at Central, the church I was at prior to coming here, and I was a youth pastor, we would play sardines. I think I may have mentioned this last week. We would play sardines a lot, and there was always a rule when we played sardines. Everyone had to hand me their cell phone. No one could play with their cell phone because cell phones, of course, have flashlights on them. And we would shut all the lights off in the church. And Central Church is a 55,000-square-foot building. 20, what would that be? I'm not good at math, but... 26,000 feet or so stacked on top of each other. So two levels, a lot of space. A lot of space to play sardines with a youth group of about 30 or 40. And so we would cram in there late at night, wait till the sun goes down. And when it got kind of late, then we'd shut all the lights off to all 55,000 square feet of the space. I would collect their phones, and we would say, no one turn the lights on, and go and disperse. And then they would go and hide in the craziest places all throughout the building. It was fun. But there was one person who couldn't obey the rules. You're looking at him. It petrified me to go look for these kids in spaces that I couldn't see anything. And of course, I was adamantly and passionately preaching. No one turned the lights on, but every room I went into, I couldn't help it, Lizzie. I broke the rules and turned the lights on. Because you don't know what's behind the corner. Or no one else would have their cell phone, but I would have mine. And I'd shine the flashlight because I couldn't handle it. It was too much for me. Oh, the darkness. I don't know if anyone else is like that. Maybe you guys love it. Maybe you need to repent today because you live in darkness because you love it so much. I'm not admitting any guilt here. Just saying that I know there are places like this out there in the world. I'm not saying that I have any experience with this or not, but nightclubs thrive in the darkness. I'm sure you guys don't know anything about that, so let me tell you about night. I don't know anything about it, just been told. So let me tell you about nightclubs. What's that? Okay. Please, I think I need it. If you were to ever go into a nightclub which thrives on low lights, and you were to turn the lights on right in the heat of the night, one, you may not like what you see. The places that thrive in the dark aren't always probably as clean as they may seem when the lights are out, or as fun or as energetic, or even as spacious as they may appear. Light has a way to cast light onto things. Also, those people that we may find that are really appealing to be beside may not look always as appealing when the lights go on. Not that anyone here has any idea about any of that. But light has a way to bring into reality that which either we may be afraid of, or even that which we're trying to hide or conceal. I don't know about you, but in my own life, if I feel like that there is an issue, whether it be at home or whether it be in my own personal life, sometimes I feel like if I just ignore it, Jeremy, that if I just don't address it, okay, if I don't get the leaves out of the gutter, they'll just magically go away. That if I don't look at them, if I don't pay attention to them, if I just turn my back to them and let them live in the dark, that somehow they'll go away and I won't have to address them. Or the scary boy that lives in my daughter's room, that if I don't, there's not literally a scary boy. If you're listening to this on podcast, there's not a scary boy. But in the imagination of my daughter, if we just ignore it, maybe it will go away. Or in our own personal lives, maybe that there's an unresolved issue in our life. But if we just bury it deep down within us and we let it live within the dark, maybe it will go away. Maybe it will just magically disappear. Maybe we won't have to deal with it if we don't give it any attention. If we let things live in the dark. I would like to take us back this morning to where the story of our faith begins. With the Israelites, God's chosen people, God's chosen nation. You know, when God is redeeming the Israelites and bringing them out of Egypt and out of slavery, he does so with a purpose. Can anyone remember what is the purpose that God is bringing the Israelites out of Egypt? If you're not familiar to Bible study, that's fine. But if this is a familiar story to you, I would love to hear from you. What's the purpose that God is bringing people out of Pharaoh's oppression? To be a nation of priests. What other purposes are there? To free them from slavery so that they can do what? It says over and over again in the book of Exodus, so that they may worship me, right? And this is a whole bit about developing a nation of priests, so that they may worship me. That at the very beginning of our story of faith, it's a story of a faithful father redeeming the people of Israel so that they may worship him. And while they're in this wilderness place for the 40 years that they are there, while they are in this wilderness place, God is developing amongst them a pattern of worship and raising up priests amongst their midst, amongst the Levites, in order to lead them in worship. God is setting structure to their worship. And maybe the centerpiece of their worship is the altar. And at the altar, there would be all sorts of offerings that the people are learning to bring to God in order to make their relationship right with God again. That the pattern and rhythms of God with his people are patterns and rhythms of worship. This is what God desires. This is the purpose of God redeeming his people out of slavery, and so that they would be freed then to have relationship with God through worship. And out of these offerings, there were peace offerings, there were sin offerings, there were meal offerings, there were burnt offerings. There were all sorts and different types. And over throughout your years of experience in the church, you've probably heard about all these different offerings. What was it about these offerings, whether it would be with meat or with birds or with spices? What is it about these offerings? What would it do? Anyone want to take a stab, a guess at all? It would create an odor. And the odor would be, oh, yeah. Thank you. You're giving me lots of opportunity to tell you today the good news. It would create an odor pleasing to God. The rhythms developed in worship became rhythms of producing good relationship and smells to God that smelled of right relationship. Can you imagine the Father up in heaven with his big fatherly heavenly nose attuned to the world? Oh boy, there's probably lots of interesting smells that God could smell if he could smell the whole world. But one particular smell would attract God's attention and turn his entire posture to the earth again. And this would be the smell of the worship of his people. And this smell would be indicative to God that relationship was restored. And this smell rising up from the altar, whether it was a peace offering, a meal offering, a burnt offering, or even a sin offering, that this smell would not only rise to the nostrils of our Father, but it also would fill the encampment and the village of the Israelites. And they would go on carrying the odor of the well-pleasing smells to God amongst their clothes. And their fabric would smell of restoration. So that there was peace now, not only between whatever was offered and God, but now there was peace now between those who were offered and the rest of the village. There was peace between God and God's people, and peace between the people and one another. That there was reconciliation and relationship restored and marked by the good smells permeating the camp, laying thick upon the fabric. We see this specifically in our passage this morning, Bonnie. We see it in verses 1 and 2, and then we see it again in verses 10. See, if we were to read the Ephesians story as the people of Israel, there would be a few key words that would come to us that would arrest our attention and remind us of our rhythms of worship. Let's read those verses again. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children and live in love. As Christ loved us, here it is, and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Verse 10, try to find out what is pleasing to the Lord. Jacqueline, try, what's Paul mean? Try to find out what is pleasing to the Lord. Oh, good Israelite, Jacqueline, the Israelite. You know what is pleasing to the Lord, an odor that is made in sacrifice. The meal offering, the burnt offering, the peace offering, the sin offering. This is what is pleasing to the Lord. The rhythms of worship amongst his people. This is what's pleasing to the Lord. But Christ being the one who was poured out, Christ being the sacrifice, Christ being the one who is the pleasing odor, Christ, the same Christ, we're talking about the same Christ, right? The one born within smelly manger, the one who hang out with the smelly lepers, and the one who gathered amongst the prostitutes with their smelly perfume, even allowing it to be poured on his feet and to let the odor of his feet be the odor of the night. This Christ, the same Christ who had nowhere to lay his head, this Christ, this is the odor that is pleasing to God. The Christ that used his body to enter into the darkness, to find the very places of life that could not emit light, and God in the person of Jesus going there with his very fingers and getting the grime underneath his nails and letting his tunic rush and brush up against the very things that create dust and dirt. That God, the very God, the true light, very man, entered into the world where shadows persist and allowed himself in his very physical being to embody the corners of the world that are dark and dungy. And some might even say sinful. That this man, how could it be, Stephen, that this man is the man whose odor is pleasing to God? Because isn't it this man whose odor smells like sinners? There's an option when it comes to darkness, I feel like, in our culture at least, Bonnie. I feel like the option here is to be apathetic. That's a fancy word for being negative, for making those statements about what we're not and who we won't be. That when we brush up against the darkness, Shelley, that we have an option to name it for what it is. And then to say, we don't do that. We've been pretty good at apophatic statements. We don't date girls that dance, smoke. No, sorry. Time out. We date girls. But we don't dance, smoke, chew, or date girls that do. You will know me as a Nazarene by the things that I don't do. You'll know me as a Nazarene by the darkness that I avoid. This could be an apathetic way of being, establishing those thick, hard line borders, and then making sure everyone knows by our statements what it is that we don't do. Leo, what's interesting about the posture of Jesus is that while maintaining perfect moral being. He enters into these places that are across the line. And instead of maintaining a posture of an apophatic stance, Jesus doesn't much say what he's against. Maybe in a few places, but in most places, Jesus, with his posture, with his being, and what I want to tell you this morning is with his presence, he proclaims who he is for. Jesus' meal offering was not one in which he took amongst leavened bread, mashed it together, and made a pleasing odor to the Lord. No, Jesus' meal offering is one in which he took actual physical bread and broke it amongst actual physical darkness, in which he shared his table, or the table of sinners. He shared his presence amongst these people. You see, the peace offering that Jesus makes is not a peace offering with the right type of bird. No, Jesus makes the peace offering with his very flesh, going into the centers of conflict and bringing together the people from the left side of the room and the right side of the room into his own flesh. See, he makes the offering with his presence. And he enters into darkness, not as a posture against it, but as a posture of light. And what is the fuel of the lamp of Christ? It's love. It's love. This is the oil of the lamp of Christ that burns bright when the darkness is settling in. And when the lights go out, the lamp that is lit is the lamp of Christ, fueled by the heart of love. And so, what is Paul's advice to us? Oh, friends, be imitators of this. Love poured out as if it was the ultimate sin offering. Love in presence poured out for darkness. My point of the sermon this morning, illustrated by two stories hopefully, is what areas of darkness exist in our life that need our presence and not our apophatic postures? What relationships exist in your life that are requiring you to make one less statement on Facebook what you're against, and to pick up the phone, and to call that person, and to move your physical presence like Jesus moves his into the same room, and to use your body to make a peace offering? What creates light? Maybe it's not a flashlight after all. Maybe it's the love of Christ imitating the love of God, pouring out our physical flesh into physical flesh, making peace and restoration in the relationships that exist in our life. How might peace be accomplished? Maybe it's not through a letter. Maybe it's through your actual physical presence. I don't know. Here's thinking about presence. Carson, I sent you a couple pictures. I experienced a lesson yesterday in presence. Oh, here we go. This is the world's best youth pastor. Her name is Megan Krebs. And she led a group of our teenagers to go, Leo, we missed you yesterday, to go play paintball. Here we are. This is not, I think a few came after this maybe, but here's our group going into a dungy, dark place that I wish they had kept the lights off. It was dirty down in there, man. It was dirty, Mark. And here we are, a group of us going to play paintball. What I love about this picture, there's a couple things. There's another one. How about the other picture, too? It's a brighter picture. There you go. There we are. After. after the paintball's done, Sammy is proclaiming, yes, I shot a kid with the paintball. Yeah. Everybody in that picture played. I was the one loser that didn't play. But everyone else, Mark was in there, and so was Joyce. Ah, Joyce is not here. I love Joyce Cooter. This chick comes to paintball yesterday in her full motorcycle gear with shoulder pads. I saw her and I go, wow, Joyce, you look puffy. She had, I don't know how many layers of pants on, and she had a huge shirt on with the shoulder pads and big gloves, and she was ready. She was going to take anything. And you know who was the very last two people? The very last two people. This is a great illustration for our church. The very last two people to come out of playing paintball was Joyce Cooter and Morgan Sumler. And here they... And here they come out of the trenches. There's only, what, 5 or 6 years between those two? And here they come out, generations separated from one another. And they're both smiling. And they're high-fiving. You know what they're telling me and Mark and Sammy? I think Sammy was there. You know what they're telling us? We were the last ones. They couldn't find us. That's another sermon on pacifism right there, right? non-passive aggression right there. They couldn't find us. They didn't have to shoot their guns. They just hid in a barrel, I guess. And they won. They won the game. They were so excited. Presence. You know, it's easy to create. This is a word. A statement I'm going to make up. But an apophatic border of what we're not against. And it's easy, at least for me, to look at a generation below me and to tell them all the things that they're doing wrong. Now, that's another thing. It's one thing to look at teenagers and to name all the things that teenagers are doing wrong, and they give us lots of material, don't they? They give us lots of material to do that. And it's another thing to imitate Joyce Cooter as she imitates Christ and to put on our shoulder pads, put on 4 extra pairs of pants, and go play paintball with someone that's 40 years younger. Now that place wasn't clean. It didn't smell good. It smelled awful. It was one of the worst smells I've ever smelled, but there was an odor pleasing to God rising up from the dungeon of that cave, and it was the odor of generations making peace with one another. In relationship, Joyce and Morgan, hand in hand, winning the battle by not firing their guns. There's gospel. There's gospel in that, man. But what about those places? I also wanted to show you those pictures because do we not have an awesome youth pastor and an awesome youth group? I mean, do we not? We don't always get to see that. But our church is hard at work in lots of areas that we don't get to see, and it's really, really beautiful. It's gorgeous. This, again, is a particular odor, but it's an odor pleasing to God. But what about those areas that persist in darkness that aren't as easy as naming someone else's flaws, like teenagers that do all the wrong things? But what about those dark areas of our relationship that's broken between us and a family member, or between us and a spouse, or between us and ourself? Those areas, those dark, shadowy corners in our life in which we don't want to shed light on. How might we follow Paul's advice and not live in darkness but live in light? May it be so. That the very posture of Christ and that the very love of Christ becomes the oil to your lamp. That as you imitate God, you also imitate a very embodied strength of God entering into those relationships in your life and facing them with your flesh. And it may stink where you go. I don't know if anyone here has someone that deals with addiction or alcoholism. It's easy to draw that border and say, we don't hang out in places where that stuff is present. But what would it look like to take on the posture of Christ and to enter into those places? Your clothes may bring the odor of alcohol. Your skin may smell of smoke. But I believe if the love of God is in your heart, then your presence will bring about light. My friend Danny Quanstrom says, "Then may it be so that darkness cannot exist where the love of Christ goes on being imitated." Isn't that beautiful? I want to say one thing that I meant to mention earlier that I failed to mention. Church, I want you to know, I love you, but God, you know, God desires in Jesus to bring you about to full transformation. That God doesn't want to leave you in your places of darkness. That I'm not sure that there's a single person in this room that wouldn't say, "Jake, that there's some place in my life that kind of feels like that nightclub. Things are fun when the lights are off, but when the lights go on, ooh, I did not want to face that." I don't think that there's not a person in this room that wouldn't say that they don't face some. And it may be easy for us to say this is where we're going to live the rest of our lives, in the tension of not being whom God wants us to be, and we're just going to have to deal with those habits, hang-ups, and addictions. No, I believe that the full love of Christ poured out for you as an offering, as a sin offering on your life, brings you into his full redemption and reconciliation. And friends, you do not have to remain there. You do not have to live the rest of your life in those same habits and hang-ups that have been a cloud over your life for your entire duration. You do not have to live there. That in Christ you can be fully restored. Our sin can be fully redeemed, that you can be holy and walk as God is holy, that you can be loved, poured out as God is love. But it's in that relationship, the relationship in which Christ is pouring out his love into your life, that our lamp is lit and we take on the same posture. It is out of this relationship that we take on the posture that allows us to step over the lines of apophatic borders and use our posture of love to be light in the midst of darkness. Without this relationship here, we'll just step into darkness and become darkness. It's this relationship here that has to be required so that we can then be like Joyce Cooter and step into the worlds that we do not belong in and let the darkness cease to exist where light lives. The last story this morning, Kevin, why don't you come on up, is a story of Chipman Commons. It's just always, there's never Scott, there's never a time where Chipman Commons isn't the right illustration to use. It's always the right illustration. We belong to a wonderful church. Andy Ewing is the husband of Kylie Ewing, who started Prodeo. And Andy is a cop here in Lee Summit, is an officer here in Lee Summit. And Andy came to Shane when Shane was looking to buy the property, and Shane was leading the charge. And Andy came to Shane, and Andy said, "Now you know, just so you know, that Chipman Commons is like the center of prostitution in Lee Summit." And Shane's like, "Really?" "Yeah, just so you know. So you know that I told you, we are sitting in the center of prostitution. An odor." Don't want to think about that as an odor, do you? But as an odor that is not pleasing to God. And here we are, seated right in the center of it. The other day, I was having coffee. One of the heads of Exodus Cry. Does anyone know what Exodus Cry is? It's a nonprofit organization seeking to rid the world of sex trafficking. It's a nonprofit organization that works to redeem prostitution. And I was having coffee with one of the heads of Exodus Cry at a table at Post Coffee in the center of prostitution. What used to be the center of prostitution. Can you find the redeeming quality in what is happening in this moment? that where once there was a place that existed for darkness, now dawn is rising in that very place. And a new horizon is setting in, and the sun is coming up, and light is pouring into the place that used to be the center of darkness. And where is this light coming from? The worship of God's people. You don't see it yet. You may never see it. I may pastor here 45 years and leave and you never see it. But I want you to know, friends, that it's not out of your good ideas. It's not out of your heart for social justice. It's not out of any of that that this place is being redeemed. It's out of your worship. It's an odor that is pleasing to God. And as we continue to come and do the same things every week, it is this sacrifice, the sacrifice of God's love into our hearts, that's allowing our presence to be light to a place that used to be dark. Whew. Praise be to God.